Counterculture Comic Podcast. This week, we continue to stalk Scott Snyder and review American Vampire. Then we'll put on our big girl pants and talk about Lilith Dark. First up, we have Dune, not a comic book, Ant-Man, a very small trailer, and reading a crap ton of books for 2015. I'm Nick Hemsing.
And I'm Brock Beauchamp. Yeah, I think I mentioned it in the last podcast that I started reading Dune. Well, I finished Dune. It was incredible. My God, I can't believe I punted on reading this book for 20 years.
Was it the worm? Did you look at the worm and say, why do I want to read a book about worms?
Exactly. That was a huge part of it. I'm deathly afraid of worms, especially, 100-yard long ones or whatever they are?
Yeah, giant meters, ones that kind of eat you and whatever you're in at the time.
They can eat, like, giant, like, semi-truck-sized things at once. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Herbert is just a phenomenal writer in so many ways. He did this trick that I've seen very few writers pull off adeptly, and that's the use a phrase. One of them was thumping, or thumpers,
mm-hmm.
and not explain it for 200 pages. And then just matter-of-factly explain it in use, and then you're like, that's what that meant. And you've been guessing at it because it creates this intrigue in the reader's mind where you're like, what's this mean? How? Well, I know thumper, you know, so it must do something, but you have no grounding in what it means. And he does it with several phrases throughout the book. And, I mean, it's just masterful from front to back. And I didn't realize that there were little things that George Lucas had pulled for Star Wars, such as the shields.
Oh.
In episode one, the droid Dekas have the same shield system used in Dune. You can roll something through it, but you can't hit it.
Yeah, so they're reactive. Which is actually kind of is an interesting form. Somebody thought of, Frank Herbert thought about that shield, he said, well, it can't just repel everything. It has to have basically work in some way that it repulses things that are hit it at a certain speed.
Yeah, because how would you let oxygen and things like that through?
Yeah. Well, and the kind of interesting part is when you look at materials that are made to stop bullets and things like that, you know, when you hit them with something moving very fast, they can, some of the materials that are kind of reactive will react differently when something hits them at a high speed.
Yeah. And
it's kind of interesting.
And I have to believe that Arrakis or Arrakis, however it's pronounced, had some influence on Tatooine.
Probably
the worship of water, the moisture evaporators, and it's just, you know, I hate to draw allusions to Star Wars with everything, but I'm Star Wars crazy right now, so that's just what I'm doing. But it was interesting because this was such an important science fiction book in the 60s, and I'm sure that it left its imprint on Lucas as well as you know, many other creators of that generation.
As I said, what I love about that book that keeps it fresh is that, and I said this last time we talked about this, that there's no way to get to Dune from here. And that's.
But what's interesting is I didn't realize that there are earthly origins in the Dune universe.
Yeah, it's something that is, you have some, there's some origins that are there, but this, the so many of the sci-fi elements of Dune are so. Some of the fantasy fiction elements of Dune are so fantastic that you can just buy them.
And if you read this book and if you haven't read it, you have to read the appendices because they explain a lot afterward. And the section on religion in Dune is hilarious.
It's been a long time since I read that, so I don't remember that.
It is such a jaded look at religion. It's basically where at some point all the religions got together and decided to write one holy book because they all basically had the same mission, you know, be good, don't screw with other people, et cetera, et cetera. And the outright revolt from them doing this is just hilarious. And it's explained in the one of the appendices. And yeah, it's just classic. you can just tell that Herbert was just wicked smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I said it's a great book. Glad you finally got it. Glad you finally got around to reading it. I've almost read it like
10 times, and then I was like, I just don't feel like it right now.
Yeah, I read it about once a decade, I think.
Yeah,
the funny thing is, I've never gone on to read any of the others.
Oh, really?
I never read Dune, Messiah, Children of Dune. I read Dune, and Dune was fantastic, and it was something about it where I said, I got everything I wanted from this.
And that's fair. I mean, it is an amazingly well self-contained story. You don't have to go read a bunch of other stuff to keep going. And actually, I'll draw an allusion to that with American Vampire as well, where there's a lot more to tell, but you're pretty satisfied by the end of it. That I wasn't tripping over myself to go read Messiah, which I'm maybe 10% of the way through now. And I thought about not reading it at all. But I didn't have anything else interesting I wanted to read, so I went with it anyway. But yeah, you can read Dune and be done with it.
I think I was afraid to read. I think I'm afraid to read Messiah. I've always been so worried that all the awesomeness that I read in Dune, that I would feel like I left the series on a lower point.
Yeah.
And just not wanting to do that kept me from reading it.
I'm kind of getting the feeling, and this is what I was hoping would happen with it, where Herbert did kind of the same thing that Orson Scott Card ended up doing later with Ender's Game and then Speaker for the Dead, where Dune involves the same characters, but it seems to have a very different feel to it. It is, at least Dune Messiah seems to have much more of a philosophical feel to it.
Mm.
Where okay. It's not the kind of straight hero's quest that Dune was.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you can let me know about it. I'm still afraid to touch it.
That's fair. But which brings us on to, I'm taking the Goodreads challenge, where it's basically you pick how many books you're going to read, and thankfully graphic novels count as well. So I picked 52. Cheater. I picked 52, which is one a week, which I should do at least 30 for the podcast, and you know, then I'll probably read about a novel a month, I think. So it's just kind of something to push myself to read a little bit more. Which I've been pretty good about lately anyway, but never hurts to set goals and all that nonsense.
Yeah, I read 2 books in the last few weeks, but they weren't fiction, so they weren't novels.
Stereo instructions?
Yeah, pretty much. No, it was somebody blathering at me for a few hours about the religion, atheism, and all that stuff, so...
Oh, that sounds thrilling.
No, yeah. actually, it was quite entertaining. I was reading Penn Jillette's books.
Oh, okay.
There's God No and Every Day's an Atheist Holiday, which are quite entertaining. I have to say that there's only one thing that to really affect me for reading those books, and it got me to stop using the term agnostic.
Oh, come on. I like riding the fence.
Yeah, but basically the truth point of it is that the second you say that this may or may not exist, you're saying it doesn't.
Yeah. No, and I've had that internal argument with myself many a time.
The faith is gone at that point. And it's like all of a sudden you go, "Well, I don't really believe that this exists." Then, well, I've kind of moved on to, yeah, okay. Well, I guess I'm an atheist. Even if I could say, "Is there any afterlife?" I say, "Well, I don't know." But merely saying I don't know pretty much means I don't believe any of this other crap.
Yeah.
Really is anything. So anyway, that's very philosophical, going into philosophy, but so yeah. So that's what I read.
But oh, go for it.
I said, but I got it made me stop using a non-committal weasel word.
Yeah, it really is a non-committal weasel word.
Yeah. But So, all right. Well, hey, next up, something else.
Ant-Man.
Ant-Man.
Now, I said this about Guardians of the Galaxy, but Ant-Man, I think, could be Marvel's first misstep.
Hmm.
And I just... They released a trailer, and it's only like 10 seconds long, and a longer one is coming in, let's see, January 6th with the premiere of Agent Carter. And I don't know. I think his name's Peyton Reed, who's directing it. And I just don't have much faith in this movie, as disappointing as that is to say. I mean, Paul Rudd is great, but I just don't know. I mean, maybe the rest of the Marvel Universe can prop this up, but... I mean, Peyton Reed isn't exactly churning out the hits. And it's not like James Gunn, where he's been hit or miss. He's had a lot of misses. I mean, his last several movies have been Yes Man, which is a Jim Carrey movie, which Jim Carrey didn't make anything good for 10 years. The Breakup, Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. I actually watched that, and it was watchable. Bring It On, which is probably the highlight of his career, as silly as that sounds, but that was actually a pretty funny movie. And then he has a lot of stuff like Down With Love, Ewan McGregor, and Renee Zellweger. Marvel, why couldn't you have worked with Edgar Wright a little bit more?
I mean, I guess I understand that there's something that they've wanted to keep so strongly consistent with some of the movies, but then at a certain point, don't you just want to make sure you have a good movie, even if it falls slightly out of theme?
Yeah, I think James Gunn had it pretty good with Guardians of the Galaxy because it was so... Compared to other movies, it was so far outside the Marvel U.
Yeah, well, he guess he said he was able to take a fair amount of license. There were some things he had to stick to, some references he had to stick to, but in general, he kind of got to do a lot.
Yeah, he just basically had to put an Infinity Gem and Thanos in the movie, and that was all he was obligated to do.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that I think Marvel is at risk of attempting to over-engineer at some point. I think that, you know, since they had sort of, you know, Joss Whedon giving the guidance for where they should go, you always have to be careful of how tight you keep those reins.
Yeah, and especially when you have people like Joss Whedon who is phasing out of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
No.
So if you're going to bring in directors that especially if you're going to do, like, if you're going to make a comedy and you bring in Edgar Wright, who has a really good track record for comedies, especially comedies that are quirky, you know, really have some odd, an odd, wonderful flavor to them, then you give him Ant-Man and you say, all right, well, let's make kind of an odd, fun, superhero-ish comedy out of this, then you kind of run with that. But then if you try and say, well, let's make this more of a Marvel superhero movie, and then we'll just bring in somebody who will do what we tell them to do.
Yeah, which, especially in a comedy, like Chris Rock came out in an interview a couple weeks ago now, and he was talking about how much harder it is to do a comedy, where if you give two talented directors a drama script, they're going to come up with something pretty similar.
But yeah, that has always blown my mind, and the great lack of respect that that the Academy has for comedies, and how difficult they are.
Oh yeah.
It's so difficult to make a good comedy. Because what makes people laugh is such a craft. You can't act a bad script in a comedy and make it a good comedy. It has to be well written. The comedy has to be kind of in the script to start. Or you could have people who afterwards, you know, kind of fix the script with their own, you know, by
ad-libbing scenes and stuff.
Ad-libbing like that. The scenes, but there's so many different parts of that. Whereas I hate to say it, but a lot of dramas you can kind of get by on just somebody taking a decent script and then just acting the hell out of it.
Yeah, with a drama you get a lot of everything is situational, where as long as the actor isn't terrible, they're probably going to convey the proper gravitas in a role that will set up a situation that will make the audience feel something.
Yeah, but you know, look how many comedies that are put out that just fall flat, and you realize that, you know, they try to hire, you know, actors that have a history in it, but sometimes that those actors and people writing for those actors can just kind of lose touch with where people are now, mm-hmm. and what they want to watch, and that, you know, it's such a moving target. And then even then, to make comedies that stand the test of time, that's even tougher. Just watched over the holidays Arsenic and Old Lace, and that movie has some elements of comedic elements that pretty much transcend. But there aren't that many movies like that. There aren't that many old comedies that you find people diving for, you know, or when people find out, get to find them as gems and go and say, well, you know, this is really funny in any age. So not only is comedy a moving target, it's so tough to write for. And then the actors actually do have to hit that out of the park, because a good joke poorly acted is a bad joke.
Yeah.
Nobody gives proper credit to it. The fans who go out and see many movies say, you know, Will Ferrell is hilarious in most everything he does, you know, but that, you know, it's like that should be transcending into some sort, or you're transferring into some sort of actual real accolades from the, you know, from the people who are supposed to really promote the, you know, people who are extremely good at their craft. It just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense that something so hard gets so little respect.
Yeah, it is interesting. You look at movies like Anchorman. Could you imagine that movie being what it was with any of the cast members rotated out?
I mean, let's just say, and not to say that Jim Carrey has always made bad stuff. Jim Carrey has made fun stuff that people like and people laugh at. But he's just not – he's difficult now for people to laugh at what he does. Mm-hmm. And maybe he doesn't have that same touch. But, in fact, one could say that he's probably arguably better in a dramatic role now than he is in a comedic role.
Oh, without a doubt. I think he's proven that a few times, where whatever comedic touch he had – is just gone. And it seems like comedians have a incredibly short shelf life. You know, there aren't many 60-year-old comedians who you want to go watch a movie starring them.
And what does it say about acting when the same people who can lose touch with comedy can pick up with drama?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. I mean, that's how, you know, most of them have a career renaissance.
Yeah. Think of all of the major roles of Robin Williams.
Yeah, you remember the dramatic ones much more now than you do the early comedic roles.
Yeah, he had some hit. He ended up getting some later hit and miss comedic roles.
Mostly miss.
But then his dramatic roles were ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were really. Overall, he was a very good actor when it came down to it. But the comedy is difficult to nail, and it moves. So it's definitely a difficult target, and I'm totally lost where we were starting with. Oh, Ant-Man.
Yeah, we were just talking about Ant-Man, but somehow we drifted off into something totally different.
That's what I'm saying. So to bring this back to Ant-Man, I think that's something that Marvel really needs to think about, is that if you're going to take one of these characters off into comedy land, if you're gonna go comedic, you really need to be careful, because that's where you actually need to pay more attention rather than less.
Yes,
because you can make a good action movie, and I think they found the formula for the good action movie. But the good comedy, one that has more comedy than just like the few jokes that are kind of sprinkled in, some of the comedy that are sprinkled into their other action movies, to keep the audience kind of consistently laughing is tough. And they were better off sticking with somebody who had a better track record in that regard, a recent track record.
Yeah, and recent. I think they'll fare a lot better adding other, like, say, horror elements into Doctor Strange.
Yes.
Then they will try, because you also set up a disparity of tone. If Ant-Man's a comedy, what happens when Ant-Man's in the Avengers?
Yes, correct.
How do you maintain that same feel for the character? And I don't know. I'm just, they've hit it out every time. And I was worried about Guardians, but James Gunn did a fantastic job with Guardians. I'm just, again, worried about Ant-Man.
But you're a baseball fan, right? I mean,
yes.
You watch who's going in and out of the roster of the Twins,
mm-hmm.
and you do some cringing sometimes, even though
absolutely
you've never seen that player take the field with the Twins before.
Yeah, but I have a pretty good idea what to expect from them. That's actually a pretty good illusion. And yeah, I'm not sold on, God, now Peyton Reed.
It's not that he is going to make a bad movie. It's just that you don't see enough of the track record to be confident.
No, and certainly not Edgar Wright track record.
And nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but they happen.
Yep.
And in comedies, it's really easy to make a bad movie. It's far easier to make a bad comedy than it is to make a bad drama.
Absolutely.
So, Goodreads, read a lot in 2015. I'll try and read a lot in 2015. I'll get on Goodreads and tag some books.
I can recommend you the Twilight series. That's a good place to start.
I will so jump right on that. I'm not even going to dig into the humor of that. That's just swinging. Mm-hmm. That's playing wiffle ball.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good books out there that I haven't read, and a lot of good classics I haven't read. So I do need to read more. So I'm always so afraid that, the only thing I'm always afraid of, I always have to be careful with genre I run into, because I have a hard time that when I'm trying to write myself, of making sure that I don't adopt the voice of something that I read recently.
Yes, that is a big problem for me as well.
It's like, I'm not worried about the story. The story, okay, that I can make, that is different enough and can be unique to me. But the voice is is tough.
Yeah, like just 2 days ago, I was reworking, very mildly reworking parts of a script that I'm drawing right now. And I had to stop and go, you're just dunifying this. Stop it. Because it's hard when something impacts you like that, not for it not to imprint on your brain. And you're like, I want to do this. Well, no, you want to do this right now because you just read it.
Yeah, it is really tough. So I'm trying to be careful about what I read, especially authors that have really strong voices in their work, because I'm like, I like this voice a lot. And then I'll start to write something down and I go, that's like that. I need to back up a second. I do have some concept of what my voice is, but I could definitely know when it kind of gets a little tainted.
Yep.
So Anyway.
Do we want to move on to American Vampire?
I guess we should.
Okay. We read the first volume, and this volume follows two stories, one written by Scott Snyder and one written by Stephen King. Art in both are by Raphael Albuquerque. Snyder's story is set in 1920s LA, where we follow Pearl, a young woman who is turned into a vampire and sets out on a path of righteous revenge against the European vampires who tortured and abused her. This story is paired with King's story, a western about Skinner Sweet, the original American vampire, a stronger, faster creature than any vampire seen before. This is a play on the New World Americanism, where everything was new and different and bigger and better, which is how many of the immigrants viewed America at the time. And Skinner Sweet is a vampire who is created just like any other vampire, but he can daywalk. And that's really the big difference. He can daywalk, but he loses the ability when there's either, I believe it's a new moon.
Moonless night, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a new moon.
New moon.
He loses all ability for 2 to 3 days.
He basically is normal. He doesn't burn in anything or anything like that, but he just doesn't have any power.
Yeah, he just reverts to something resembling a normal human being. And I'm so glad we read this as a volume, because the first issue would have left me incredibly disappointed because I was completely lost as to what the hell was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the end of the second issue, I started getting a good idea of it. And just as you'd expect from King and Snyder, the writing is exceptionally clever.
Yeah, it's almost kind of funny that the Snyder part of it definitely feels like it's following a King type story development.
Absolutely. I mean, this has Stephen King's fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, well, first of all, Skinner Sweet is a
Stephen King
character in the extreme.
Yeah, I mean, just...
He's Randall Flagg in a way. Mm-hmm. What else would he be? He's a couple different characters.
He's the ultimately evil, but incredibly charismatic and charming. And you can't help but like the character.
Yeah, you like him, but there's something that he's up to. The weird thing is that he could be up to something that you're not necessarily sure that you could disagree with.
Yeah.
In a weird way. I mean, at the beginning, he's here. You get the shock of how evil he is. And then he goes along and you're like, there's something different going on with this character. You know, this character is doing this now. And why is that?
Yeah. And he starts pursuing the European vampires, who are despicable in all the old world sort of ways, with a class or caste system. And they're just horrible. I mean, they're basically the European bourgeois, you know? And Skinner Sweet takes it upon himself to go kill them all. And you're cheering for Skinner Sweet because he's a charismatic, likable character. But then he succeeds and he's like, now I get to go do all this other stuff. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute there. Slow your roll, buddy. You really are evil.
Yeah. He's a character that you, I guess the trick it pulls on the reader is that it's trying to make you like the villain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in some ways succeeding.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Which means that the other trick it plays on it, it makes you buy into, well, looking at all this other stuff he did, and then you start giving a pass on it.
Yep.
Because you like the character, which is kind of foul.
Oh, absolutely. And they do a very good job of tricking you into liking this character and making you think that he's not a bad guy. But to do so, you have to ignore all the truly awful things he did. And then at the end, I suddenly came to the realization, wait, I've been cheering for a horrible character.
Yes.
And...
Yeah. And then at a certain point, you sort of start to metagame it, and you start thinking, well, I know some of Stephen King's other characters.
Yeah.
And you start trying to, like, you know, play, you know, which hole does this peg fit in? You know that he does play with that concept a bit. And the, you know, is it going to be, Leland Gaunt? You know, is he going to get away and move on? You know, at some point, depending on which version, which ending of that story you like, the TV or the book.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Does Randall Flagg, who just kind of keeps moving on, does he have his comic book comeuppance, and does he finally eat it?
And given the Western setting, it's hard to ignore a little bit of Roland in there as well.
Yeah, well, yeah.
He's never nearly the moralistic character that Roland is, though.
No, he's more the walking dude. He's like that eternal evil character that you never, that Stephen King basically says you never quite get rid of.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's what I want to think when I look at that character, but you just don't know that the hell that character will put a lot of people through, if they'll, if they will be triumphant in the end, or if it'll be a Pyrrhic victory.
And we shouldn't ignore Pearl, who is the heroine of the other 1920s set story.
Oh, she's the one that I'm curious if she's the one who becomes victorious or not.
Yeah, and she is much more of a moralistic character. And I was saying we shouldn't ignore her simply because her story is just as good as the Skinner Suite story, at least in my opinion it is.
No, it is. It is. It's a great story. Scott Snyder does a great job. She's a great character.
And the art is done by Raphael Albuquerque. And he changes his style slightly between the 1920s and 1880s story. The 1880s is a lot looser and uses an ink wash to do some of the shading. And I think that made me like the 1880s story a little bit better, because it is such a gritty way of drawing it. It's just beautiful. And then he cleans it up a little bit for the 1920s story. I think it's the difference, I think, visual representation of the dirty kind of sliminess of Skinner Suite versus the more righteous side of Pearl. And both art styles are lovely, but the 1880s art style is just phenomenal, just so well executed. The art and coloring, I don't know if he did the coloring as well, but it's top notch. And I was really impressed, especially by the 1880s story.
It definitely accents the themes of both.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it has a very 1920s, roaring 20s type of feel to the Snyder story. And then the Stephen King has a very messy, kind of loosely drawn, agitated, and maybe a little bit menacing ink wash style. And it's great. I was really blown away by the art.
And what a Stephen King hero, and one of these, the hero that whose only victory is to not give in.
Yeah. we should mention that all of this has a backdrop of a narrator who wrote a book witnessing the 1880s Skinner Suite early part of his story, and then writing it as fiction. So this entire story is encapsulated by one writer who is basically always along for the ride, basically. And he keeps saying one phrase, you know, if you can keep up. Can I tag along? If you can keep up. And so the writer is explaining a lot of the story. And it works well because the writer's at three different points in his life, and he's nearing death in the last part of the story. And yeah, this is just a really well-crafted story. Scott Snyder, I believe, framed the entire story, and then Stephen King scripted his part of it.
Hmm. It's a great story. It's a great read.
It really
especially
is.
especially since I go into a vampire story not wanting to like it.
Yep, same here.
The undead vampire, I think sometimes the only interesting thing to really do is in this case they destroy the European European version of the vampire and sell something that is more uniquely American.
Yeah, so. It's basically destroying the European aristocracy and replacing it with, you know, good old fashioned American can do.
Well, or more about the, you know, there's a long, slow, you know, development of the European vampire, and it's, you know, its attachment, as you said, to the aristocracy, and, you know, this it gains this sort of nobility, and frankly, the United States has a more, you know, there's the frontier, the glorification of the frontier hero, the less, you know, the less, what do I say, less cultured, more, you know, more gritty and more, one man and his guns sort of view of the Old West, and also, you know, complete abandonment of anything that has to do with, you know, or the lack of attachment to the proper way of doing anything.
Yeah.
And
it's the American pioneer attitude versus the old world European.
Yeah, attitude. which means you're not trying with this book. You're not trying to sell that the same vampire. So you get to do something fun and different. I mean, but we've seen the Americification of a lot of other European constructs before, and sometimes that's the only way to make it interesting is to do something that least of all we're like, okay, well, this is more us, and not try and sell us the same. Yep. So, and we have a lot of unique parts of our history, which in this Old West and then 1920s, though, you know, especially like 1920s Hollywood.
Yeah, those are so uniquely American.
Yeah, and this place hits both of them.
Yep.
This book hits both of them. So you really get to do. I think 1920s are still an era that people of this generation, people more recent generations, they have a certain romanticism about, but don't truly understand.
Yeah, don't understand that the end of the decade, you know, marked the beginning of the Great Depression.
Yeah, end of the decade,
Great All Depression. That opulence led to a lot of bad things.
Well, and it was a post-war era, also known as one of the wars that a lot of the younger generation completely forget existed.
Yeah.
The Great War, the war to end all wars. Except for the next one. was quite possibly one of the worst and ugly. After the Civil War, was horrible and brutal. And then World War I was horrible.
Oh, yeah, because they had all these offensive weapons, but they didn't have any of the defensive weapons.
Exactly.
I said that backwards, actually. They had all the defensive weapons. They didn't have the offensive weapons. They had the Gatling gun. You know, they had the machine gun, but they didn't have usable tanks to roll through those machine guns.
You saw the beginning of tanks, but not the...
But they weren't useful at that point. There was no air force to speak of. They were literally dropping bombs out by hand, which is about as effective as throwing a grenade. So you had all these, which created the trench war system, and it was just brutal.
It was a meat grinder.
Yeah, it was.
So so you had this really horrible war, and the 1920s were after that war. The United States is riding high again, you know, or riding high on, well, not again, I guess, so much as riding high, you know, after the war. And then, you know, you had And then all of that goes crashing to an end. But you had so many different things going on through all of that. I mean, when did Prohibition end?
Prohibition ended, I think, in 33.
Yeah, 33. So you had Prohibition that went from 19. Oh,
I want to say like 21, something yeah. like that.
Yeah. So meanwhile, you have a bunch of people who are drinking, except it's illegal. And partying, and you know, skirts got shorter.
Mm-hmm. I was so close. 1920 to 1933. I was off by 1 year on the front end.
Yeah. So for the entire decade in the United States, alcohol was illegal.
Yep. And people drank it like water.
Yeah. You have the birth of the you have the true birth of the American mafia.
Yeah,
I mean, just a crazy, crazy time, and then crazy for design and style and art as well. Mm-hmm. And the grasping the proper context for that entire decade is so difficult because there's so many things going on.
It was so turbulent. From front to back. I mean, it started on a super high note at the end of the war. Things just roared through, and economy was growing by leaps and bounds, and then it crashed in 1929.
Yep. So there's your history lesson, everyone.
Yeah. Well, about American Vampire, what I want to bring it up with Dune is I was so completely satisfied reading this book, I kind of don't want to read any more of it.
The only thing that keeps me wanting to read more of it is I'm kind of curious where Skinner's Sweet story goes.
As am I.
It's like, damn it, you've made me like this character enough that I want to know where he goes.
I think he's just going to be rotten, so that's why I'm kind of hesitant to read it.
Yeah, he's definitely going to stir. He's going to stir up stuff. He's going to cause. He's going to do some things you agree with. On some very basic primal American level, and then he's going to be someone who screws over some other characters that you like, and then you're going to say, yeah, this guy needs to go away. Now he's done some things that are really bad, and now I want to see him die, but he won't die, and the price that I pay for liking him is that somehow he doesn't entirely lose.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, that's just me guessing, but I haven't read the rest of it. But somehow, that's me going forward with that kind of character in a Stephen King, with that kind of Stephen King character.
So I think we both give this a real solid read. It.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think we criticized anything about the book at all.
No, except you really may have isn't.
Said. Except you said that if you had only read the first issue, you wouldn't have known where it was going.
Yeah, it didn't do a good job setting it up, but we read the first volume, so that all worked out.
Yeah, so, all right. Read that. And then...
let's move on to Lilith Dark.
Yep, Lilith Dark.
Okay, Lilith Dark has no time for tea parties and princess stuff. She's far too busy fighting off wicked creatures and fantastic beasts, or at least that's how she imagines things. One day, Lilith follows a mysterious kitten into an old tree and discovers an entire world of real beasties that has been living right under her nose. With her big sister held captive, Lilith must face her fears, rescue her sister from the evil beasties, and save the day before bedtime. Created by Charles Dowd, which can be found at cdowd.com. CDOWD.com. You can also find this book on Amazon or Comixology. I've known Charles online for a while, and... Super good dude. I supported his Kickstarter quite some time ago. I only read the book now, which is typically how I do Kickstarters. I'm terrible about it.
We support you.
Yeah.
But with money, not so much the reading.
It's like the line from Hansel and Zoolander. I really like Sting. I don't listen to his music, but I really appreciate that he's out there making it. Just kidding. No, but this book is...
There you go, Charles.
Yep, there you go.
You are Sting.
You can put that on the inside of a book cover.
You are Sting.
Yep. But this book is really adorable. It draws heavily from Calvin and Hobbes, particularly the Spaceman Spiff and Stupendous Man alter egos. Stupendous Man was always my favorite as a kid, and reading this book just put a smile on my face.
It's just fun. It's just fun and cute.
Yeah, it really is. It's perfect reading to a kid, especially if you have a little girl, because there aren't that many little girl empowerment stories out there. Yeah. And it's, I think he created this specifically so he had something to read to his daughter, which is awesome. I mean, what better reason can you have to create something? And I only read the first issue because I was just going to stick to that. But I did send you the second issue as well. I don't know if you read it.
I did.
You did?
As you said, because you sent it to me. And they're pretty fast reads. I mean,
yeah, they
it's
are.
It's kind of the first issue really has that has a an episodic, you know, couple page episodic webcomic feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a couple just short little instances that, you know, are kind of cute and a little funny. I really could imagine, you know, a kind of kids getting a lot more out of it because it's kind of cute and funny. But it has some moments that are. I thought the second issue got in a little bit more where I was into the. It kind of flattened out a little bit less single episodes, and then kind of going on to a little bit more of a longer adventure.
Okay.
But I think the selling it first with the little shorts is good. I mean, I don't even know how long the next story is because it goes past the second issue.
Yeah, he has a volume out, and I think it's the first five issues, maybe.
Lilith Dark and the Beastie Tree.
Yeah, yeah. And I do love how he refers to everything as beasties.
Well, I like how everything has a fun kid mispronunciation or misspelling that actually makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I like the cannonballs.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of great. I think it's great because they're totally believable. Totally believable mispronunciations that you would actually want to believe a kid would say it that way. And it actually, it removes the horror of anything, what anything really is, and turns it into a, you know, a villains from a child's point of view.
Mm-hmm. One minor quibble I had is the resolution of the book he sent me, and I'm going to heckle the crap out of him for this. Was super pixelated on my iPad. I don't know how you read it.
I read it. You know, I did read it on a 10-inch screen, so it wasn't super. They were smaller files, and you could tell that the it wasn't the highest resolution.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I think you are far. You're far more likely to spot.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I do for a living. So, yeah I'm
so I didn't pay attention to it as much as you did, honestly.
I'm going to be a pain in the ass about it. I mean, that's
it didn't really bother me.
But I mean, it didn't really detract from the story at all. And I have a feeling if you go pay the dollar or whatever he's charging per issue on Comixology, that's not going to be the case at all. So, you know, don't think that's any kind of barrier to going and reading this book, because you know, this was a Kickstarter I supported. Oh boy, I bet I supported it 2 years ago. It was quite some time ago.
Yeah, I supported his second Kickstarter. Well, I don't know if it was the second one, but a more recent Kickstarter, which was
I saw you supported that. Yeah, and I had missed that somehow, and I didn't know.
It's because you're a bad person.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Or it's because you said, well, I'm really glad that he's making stuff, but I'm not really going to read it.
Hey, I supported his first one. Come on, cut me some slack, you bastard.
I mean, not enough to read anything. I mean, I'm not necessarily sure. You could say some artists are like, yeah, thanks, you gave me money. What did you think about it? Oh, I think it's so great that you're making that.
I dig the cover, man. Dig the cover.
I dig the cover. I mean, I'm sure there's some good stuff inside there.
But
I did love the ambushing of the unicorn.
Oh God, that was funny. Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
I was reading that, and it was my wife was still asleep, and I'm reading this on the tablet, and I really need to find a pillow or something to not laugh.
Yes, that took me completely by surprise. And telling the audience what the Unihorn is will give it away. But yeah, so you need to read it. Yeah.
So, but if we're where we're going with this is, you should read it.
Yes, because it is very cheap. You can get them for very cheap.
That is not the selling point.
No, well, I'm saying in a world where, you know what?
You should read this because it is very cheap. I mean, whoa. Talk about killing with faint praise. I mean, that's just... Do you really want him to listen to this?
No, I don't.
You should read this because it is very cheap. Wow.
Charles, you can put that in the back cover.
You know, if I sell anything, like any piece of art, you're not getting on the cover comments. That's just not happening. Uh-huh. You should read this because Nick made the price $2 cheaper than other fiction out there.
Well, I'm saying that because I'm still reeling from the fact that last night I wanted to go read the last two volumes of the new Mitch Gerads Punisher. And Marvel is charging $18 for a digital trade paperback. And I'm still reeling from that. It just made me so mad where issues that are 10 months old are still $4, where I can walk into a store and buy it, the physical copy, and get a digital copy for $4. So, yeah, it's not the most, redeeming point of this book. But when put into context, you scurvy bastard, it makes more sense.
Yes, but that's what you led with.
I know I led with it. Shut up.
This is a damning with faint praise.
Yeah.
It's cheap. You can get it, the Kindle version, for less than $5.
Yes.
For the volume.
But if you have kids, it's absolutely a worthwhile investment because I believe the collected edition is... let's see here. It's 155 pages.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
I thought it said 120 somewhere. Okay, never mind. It's the paperback's 120.
Oh, it says...
on Amazon, anyway.
It says 155 on Comixology.
Oh, well, maybe it includes some extra stuff on Comixology.
Must. But it's $6. I'm probably going to pick it up here in a few days. And because it's cheap.
Okay, that's great. Hey, Charles, if you're listening to this,
thank you for putting
a cheap book out there.
I'm going to link to
shill for. No,
I'm going to hammer him on social media with a link to this podcast.
Yes.
And it's just going to say it's cheap in capital letters.
Cheap, buy it.
but there aren't a lot of really good kids books that are geared especially for little girls.
Well, kids, I think there's not a lot of kids comics that you can look at later and say, well, you know, they make some assumptions that a lot of superhero comics are supposed to be kind of like kids comics. But I think this is one cuter, two more innocent, and it's the beauty is in the innocence.
It's closer to Calvin and Hobbes than it is Spider-Man. But one thing, the writer of Spider-Man, Dan Slott, said something a few months back that made me completely reevaluate how I feel about superhero books, at least some of them. He said, listen, you read this as a kid and you enjoyed it. Now that you're older, how selfish is it of you to say comic books should be older now? Because there's a generation of children behind you that should get the same experience as you got. And I was like, you know, that's a really good goddamn point.
Well, I don't think that... first of all, I was not that kind of... I never had the same attachment to those characters as a kid because I just wasn't a superhero comic book reader. I mean, I think the problem that I have more with them than anything else is that when they are... when they attempt to do some things that are quasi-adolescent or quasi-adult, and really they either insult They either are insulting people by saying, you know, this is the ideal version of this, mm-hmm. like what they do a lot of times with female characters, or they do these repeat mockeries of more adult events, like these big marriage things and things like that. I mean, I guess the whole superhero universe, I mean, that's, you know, it's just a big sandbox and you can have fun with it. And if that's, you know, just the, you know, kids playing out some of that fantasy, then that's fine.
Oh yeah. I'm not excusing all the mistakes that have been made in superhero books over the years.
I just think the problem that I always have with them is that they, is just that they try to mess with things that are older to try and keep an older audience. Or at worst, they try and keep they appeal to real base desires, mm-hmm. and make kind of a disgusting appeal to certain audiences. And I think that's a fair criticism. I don't think, I mean, yeah, if you want to say that you do a lot of funny stuff to appeal to the kids, or a lot of different stuff to appeal to the kids, and the same thing you read as a kid and don't want to grow up, that's fine. But you can't use that to excuse the other things.
No, it doesn't give you a pass for, it does not absolve you for all the horrible mistakes that have been made. I'm not gearing that at Dan Slott at all. Dan Slott's actually, in my opinion, a pretty damn good superhero writer. So, but I just found that take interesting, and how selfish it is for people to demand that comic books, or specifically mainstream superhero comic books, grow up with them and leave behind the generation of children that might want to read it.
Well, yeah, but and also keep in mind, they also do a fair amount of works that are attempts to deliver grown-up content. I mean, some of that stuff, when they delved into really dark stories, that's exactly what they were trying to do.
Oh, for sure.
Trying to appeal to an older audience. And those characters really fall apart when you try and do that.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be really careful. At best, it only works as stunts. I mean, Dark Knight Returns is kind of a, you know, it's kind of a stunt separate comic. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a great comic, but it's obviously out of canon. It's out of canon for a reason. It's because it's trying to appeal to a different audience than the main.
Yeah.
But if you do try to grow them up too much, yeah, they fall apart because they're not meant for that. So, anyway,
and we have derailed this.
And we've gone derailed, and we've gone way far, and you should buy, you know, Charles Dodd's book because it's $2.
No, you should buy it because the price is quite palatable.
Yeah, and you should buy it maybe because it's good.
Yeah, also because it's good.
Okay, so, all right, so read that. Read
and again,
American
you can...
Vampire. Don't read both of them to your kids.
No, read one of them to your kids, not the other. I'll let you choose which one.
Which one? I mean, I don't know. Some people read different things. I mean, I watched Aliens when I was probably 8 years old.
So. I read it when I was 12.
No, Aliens was came out in 88. So no. Aliens came out in
86.
So yeah, I saw that in the theater when I was 10. So,
but yeah. Yeah, again, you can find Charles' stuff at cdowd, cdowd.com. So that's about it for this week. We haven't picked a book for the next podcast, whether we record it a week or 2 weeks from now. I don't know if you have anything lined up, but I do not.
I think you sent over some other suggestions, but let me dig through some books, and there might be some things I might be interested in reviewing.
Yeah, at some point in the near future, I'd like to review... All You Need Is Kill.
Because, oh, yeah, that was one of the ones you sent.
Yeah, that's based off, or I should say The Edge of Tomorrow is based off that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yep. I'm more interested. Actually, I just got the Blu-ray for that because I hadn't seen it yet.
Oh, it's so good. You need to watch it.
I know. That's what I kept hearing. Is that the anyway, we won't make this much longer. But yes, it's something I've really been wanting to see because I heard that it was definitely not what you would have thought originally.
No, not at all. It is excellent. Both Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt are fantastic in it, and I am reading the manga simply because I found the movie so awesome.
Cool. All right. So, okay. so let's wrap this up and go home.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Be sure to drop us a line at countercomic@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at schlockworks.com, where you can view our podcast archives or check in on some of our other projects. If you're so inclined, drop by iTunes or Stitcher and give us a review. That's all I have for this week. I'm Brock Beauchamp.
I'm Nick Hemsing, and you should listen to us because we're free.
The price is quite palatable.